Welcome to the inaugural episode of Open Source Underdogs, the podcast where we interview leaders from successful open source software companies and bring their stories to you. Today, I'm in my hometown of Austin, Texas, with Peter Wang, CTO and co-founder of Anaconda. With more than 6 million users, the open source Anaconda distribution is the fastest and easiest way to do Python and R data science and machine learning. Peter, could you start by telling us about your background and how Anaconda got started?
My background is actually in physics, and I ended up going to software after college because I really like coding. And I sort of found my way to doing consulting using the Python scientific DAC, if you will. And that was in kind of the early and mid-2000s. And as I did more work in that area, I realized that there were significant commercial adoption opportunities for Python, but the scientific stack was, you know, it was still coming together at the time, right? There were some significant gaps and difficulties in how to use it. Then once I saw the big data wave starting to hit, I recognized that enterprise data analytics would be something that Python would be very good at, and people already starting to self-service and use Python for, but there were gaps. And so we started actually as Continuum Analytics in order to promote the use of Python for data science and data analytics beyond just scientific computing. So we wanted to do some innovative projects to fill some gaps and holes and things like that. And then also to build a enduring and sustaining open source software company.
Who are the customers of Anaconda?
Our customers are large, medium-sized companies that buy our enterprise software. So that is a machine learning and AI enablement platform. It's a very different pile of bits than most people in the open source world who download free Anaconda are used to thinking about. And so that's, you know, the enterprise customers buy that in order to support their data scientists that are using Anaconda internally in their businesses.
What's the value proposition of Anaconda?
When you look at what data scientists need to do, there's a lot of data they need to get access to. There's a lot of compute they need to run their stuff on. They need to do a lot of different things that actually traditional enterprise IT is not very well equipped to support them in. So our enterprise platform comes in and gives IT an easy way to provide a governed and secure compute environment for data scientists. They can collaborate, build models, build notebooks, build interactive dashboards, gives data scientists an easy way to also deploy those in a production way. Now, in businesses, a lot of data scientists can put toys together. They can't, for them to then throw that over the fence and get IT to make something that actually runs for other people in the business to use, that can take a very long time. So the enterprise platform eases the deployment. It gives IT a way to manage and to govern the kinds of data science that's done. Gives data scientists access to packages and software internally inside the enterprise firewall. And for people who have only lived in the open source world, that may sound really strange, but a lot of people, they live in corporate environments that are very locked down. They can't get access to software. So with Anaconda Enterprise, we provide a way for IT to feel good about there being a vendor to provide the software. And the data scientists are happy because they get the latest and greatest versions of all the packages they want.
What have been some of the challenges of using open source as part of the business model?
So one of the things is that we both use open source in building our enterprise product. We also, what the enterprise product does is makes open source available for people to use, right? So there's things like machine learning libraries, like scikit-learn, that we don't write and we provide. So there's challenges associated with simply providing open source to enterprise users. Then there's additional challenges of just using open source software in our proprietary enterprise software, right? There's sort of two sets of challenges. With the former, with the distribution of open source software, I would say that most businesses are actually starting to understand that open source software is a key part of the software development stack. For machine learning and AI applications in particular, it's an integral part of it. You can't do it without using open source software. So enterprise IT is starting to clue into that fact. The challenges we run into are that even though they are clued into this, there's still procurement and legal and security and governance questionnaires that come down to us that sometimes you're just like, WTF. You look at this and you're like, there's no way we can make reps and warranties on a piece of open source software that has global contributors, right? Or yeah, we have customers asking for like unlimited indemnity on something or the other. And it's like, you know, we don't even write half the software. It's your users internally that want to use it. You know, we're just making this available for you. So there's like some of those kinds of, I would say, disconnects and impedance mismatches between enterprise expectations. The biggest challenge, I would say, is that enterprises – they think of data analytics providers and vendors like SAS or someone like that, that comes in with a big giant piece of shrink wrap, very expensive shrink wrap software that's all just that vendor's bits. And so they're used to interacting with vendors in that way. So when we come in and we say, we're a vendor that's an enablement platform, we have our pilot bits, we indemnify and support it and provide you warranties. But then part of that is we provide fluid and rapid access to a ton of additional capability in the open source ecosystem. They really have a hard time. It's really legal oftentimes that has this challenge of separating, you know, the bits that the vendor wrote and the bits that the vendor is providing access to. They have a really hard time disambiguating those two sometimes.
Can you talk a little bit more about what makes or what defines a platform and what does that mean exactly to you?
So for me, a platform is something that it's like a market, right? So it facilitates an interaction between providers of value and consumers or users of value. And it makes it from an M times N problem to a smaller, like M plus N kind of problem. So in our case, we have, you know, there's hundreds and hundreds of developers of open source libraries that want people to use their software and that, you know, they have a lot of capability there. And then there's thousands, tens of thousands, millions of people inside businesses that want to use the software, but they don't know which software they should use. They don't know what software is secure to run, what versions are the most up to date, things like that. Our platform essentially is a bridge between the open source innovation space and development around these machine learning libraries to the enterprise, very governed environments in which the software needs to run. So creating a place where people can bring their goods, so to speak, so in this case, software packages and capabilities, notebooks, it could be data sets, whatever, and then where the consumers of those things can come and actually pick what they want. That's what makes it a platform. So we ourselves, of course, we build quite a bit of functionality into the platform, but we're really letting this additional generative activity happen inside it. It's not merely, oh, here's a big pile of software, and then we have some extension points for other people to plug in things. It's not a plug-in ecosystem. It really is a platform that provides people. It's this bridge that lets people go both ways.
On your website, I noticed anaconda.org mentions a cloud offering. Mm-hmm. Is that a direction that you think is promising, or is the main focus the enterprise software suite?
So I've always been very interested in data science in the cloud. Actually, one of our first offerings as a company in 2012 was a cloud-based on-demand notebook computation system called Wakari. And then we eventually shut it down because that's a very hard way to make money at the time. And it takes a lot of capital to actually get a software as a service company going. And so right now, Anaconda Cloud, as it exists, is mostly a place for people to host packages and notebooks and to share those with people, but we don't actually execute those notebooks on people's behalf. In the future, I cannot make any promises about our long-term product roadmap, but I do feel like cloud-based execution of notebooks and of models, things like that, it's a natural need that emerges, and you know, we may do something in that space.
What are the most promising areas that you're investing in or looking to innovate in the future?
Well, you know, the space moves so quickly and it's evolving quite a bit. So we really are looking at, I think for most enterprise software companies, what would be considered very short time windows for innovation, sort of new de novo innovation work. We're mostly right now investing in the existing projects that we have. We're also invested. There's a new project we just released for data access to really solve that data reproducibility and data sharing problem. Lightweight data catalog and data access library called Intake that we're very excited about. But moving forward, we're going to be looking at doing, you know, more things with regard to model management and helping people share models in a more reproducible and seamless way. And, you know, beyond that, it really depends on how the business evolves.
So of those different areas where you could generate revenue, mm-hmm. which one is generating the most revenue as a percentage? Is it license?
We're primarily, the vast majority of our revenue comes from software licenses. That wasn't always the case. We actually made a pretty dramatic change over the last year, flipped almost completely 180 degrees around from being mostly consulting with some relatively small amount of software revenue to the other way around, where it's mostly software revenue and a much smaller amount of consulting, training, services, things like that.
Can you share any details about how you went about licensing?
We started as a company to support and promote the growth of Python for Data Science. So we're something that's very much of a community, right? It's not like Travis and I sat down and said, oh, aha, we have this genius idea for some crazy new cool technology. We build it and then we vend it. It's we're of this community. We built more innovations to help amplify the efforts of the community, but we're always of the Python data science community. So the ethos of that community is to license everything permissively. So MIT, BSD licensed, LGPL sometimes. And so it wasn't really feasible to do any kind of open core business model around that. Some communities, R is different, right? The R data science community, R is all GPL based. And so classically, there have been two companies, one got acquired by Microsoft, that were heavily doing work in R around open core model. In the Python world, I don't feel like the community has an appetite for open core business models. And so we very quickly came to understand either A, we have to sell something directly to the community. So our users and they are our customers, or we figure out some kind of enterprise software that we sell that is a proxy need, fills a proxy need, or is a proxy to the open source and free stuff that we give away. So the business model we converged on was essentially that. We give away this stuff, you know, you give away burgers and you sell the Coca-Cola or something like that, right? It's not, you get a free burger, but if you want two patties or if you want the burger with cheese, then you pay extra, right? That's not the model we have. So Anaconda, all the work I do around Anaconda and the packages, the distribution, all the testing we do, all that stuff we give away for free, we will give it away for free forever. Because we know that when businesses start using this stuff more and more and more, it will drive proximate need for other kinds of things. And the first significant proxy need that showed up was the need for a management platform or some way of managing and governing the use of open source data science packages inside the business. Then it became managing the collaboration around Jupyter notebooks and things like that. And now lately it's evolved much more into deploying models and looking at how models are running. You know, the actual models in production is a much larger part of what's driving business pain. And so those are prominent, all three of those things I mentioned, the repository and package governance, the collaboration, and then the management of models in production, all three of them are core components of our platform offering in our enterprise product.
Would it be fair to describe that as tools around the open source?
I don't know if it's tools as much as it's, I mean, the nature of the software itself is to provide an infrastructure for, you know, spinning up servers, deploying things. They're not really tools as such. I mean, actually the end user experience when they're sitting there, like if you're a business user at a customer that's bought Anaconda Enterprise, you're using the browser, log into our enterprise platform and you get the Jupyter notebook experience there. You can also use Anaconda as you've always used it on your laptop or something. And the Conda package manager will connect to your internal package repository. So it's not like you're getting extra tools. You have the same tools you've always had from an actual data science day-to-day perspective, but using them in an enterprise environment is much easier for you now.
Maybe switching gears a little bit, mm-hmm. The marketing side, does Anaconda just sell itself because the community has this strong underlying, you know, science Python community? Mm-hmm. Or what are some of the channels that you use to get the software out there?
Well, so the enterprise software, very few things in the world sell themselves. and the reason is twofold. One, if there's not much demand for what you're doing, then you have to go and tell everyone about what you're doing. If there is a lot of demand for what you're doing, you're going to have competitors that race in and provide messaging around why their product's better than yours, right? So in both cases, if there is or if there isn't demand, you've got to be doing some kind of selling. Now, for us, the machine learning platform, data science platform, that term is now a term of trade, right, in the business. So we have people at the CIO level, CTO level that are like, okay, we need a data science platform, right? And they know what that is. They know it's something they need to do to support their data scientists. Now, it does help us that those data scientists will tend to already be Anaconda users. We do have access to our mailing lists and our social media and whatever else. We have a pretty visible, we're pretty well known as a brand. So the brand, everything is top notch. We're known for our investments, interaction with the open source community. So all that stuff helps us in the actual sales process. But at the end of the day, we do have to do marketing. We do have to inform people about what the features are, why they would buy. It's like any other piece of software you're trying to sell. Like, there's real activity you have to do there.
So without going into actual prices, but maybe mm-hmm. just around pricing philosophy, were you able to quickly figure out what your price should be? Have you changed a lot over time?
It's changed a lot over time. Depending who you're selling to, it really, you know, we've always been in the enterprise sales sort of mode for our support, training, things like that, as well as for our products. So from the beginning, we had this understanding that enterprise sales is a different kind of animal than, you know, consumer sales, setting prices and all those things. There's a whole process to sales and sales strategy. And neither my co-founder nor I would claim to be experts in that, although we have some perspectives and some background in it. So it was important to actually work with salespeople that kind of knew what they were doing. And we've been evolving over time. We've been learning over time how that whole thing works.
Maybe we could talk a little bit about partnerships. Mm-hmm. Do you have a strong partner network, or who are the partners that you've built up over time that you think have been important to you getting out there and getting to market?
So partnerships, we've always worked with some other companies, but in terms of actually driving to sales success, that's been a fairly targeted activity over only the last couple of years. Because using partners as a channel, their salespeople have to know how to sell your product, right? They have to know how to close a deal and include your product in the pricing. So you have to have really, really clear definition of what is the product, how to talk about it as an integrated part of the partner offering, all those different things. And I would say that that's, again, that's something we've only been doing relatively recently. Prior to that, our partnerships really consisted of technology partnerships and sort of marketing and exposure kinds of things. I mean, the data science field itself is also relatively new, at least in terms of enterprise adoption of the stuff. So we actually partner with, there's sort of two classes of folks. One of them are hardware vendors, actually. So Intel, NVIDIA, Microsoft, the cloud vendors like Microsoft, Google, Amazon, all that. But the hardware vendors, AMD, Intel, NVIDIA, and gosh, I'm probably forgetting some others there. Oh, IBM, obviously they have hardware. So with those, we are partnered on technology as well as some go-to-market activities. So we have a compiler called Numba. We have a distributed computing system, Dask. Those are very, very exciting for these hardware partners because they want to showcase their chips running at scale. They want to showcase the kind of performance wins. Now, if they require end users to have to write extremely low-level code in order to get those wins, it's a non-starter, right? So the idea is it's not just performance, but it's performance that's accessible. So using our tools and technologies, they can get your average data scientist, not some like C++ optimization nerd. Your average data scientist can use some of our libraries and then be running these things, you know, and really showcasing the performance. So that's the hardware partnerships. Then the cloud partnerships, as well as some others, they're really around the data science tools, around notebooks or visualization. Some cases, they've been our enterprise platform as well. So it really depends. So like with Microsoft, for instance, we have partnered multiple ways. So our Anaconda distribution is installed on Azure. It's available as the Python runtime inside SQL Server itself, which is pretty cool. It's something you can install as part of the default Visual Studio installer. If you say, I'm a data scientist, and you select that profile, it will install Anaconda for you. So that's a really cool partnership. And then on the flip side of it, we've included the VS Code editor inside the Anaconda distribution installer so that that's one of the editors and IDEs that's available for end users. So there's multiple aspects of our Microsoft relationship, but those are probably the most significant ones. But these partnerships are very exciting for us. They're still in the early stages. You know, right now, we would love to see driving more revenue through those. We're investing in those relationships because we believe we will be able to drive a lot more revenue through them.
What about let's say, business partnerships, any organizations or foundations or other communities that you found have been really useful for you to promote the product?
Oh, yeah. Well, so we primarily stay in the data science space, right, in the Python sort of ecosystem. We've been growing our inclusion of the R ecosystem as well, because many data scientists use both Python and R. And so we're trying to find better ways to play nicely and be a good participant in that ecosystem. But in the Python side, we're actually, I would say, pretty unique in that we started the company in January of 2012. And then by March, we'd started the effort to create a nonprofit to support and sustain several open source projects in the Python ecosystem. That nonprofit's called NumFocus, and that's been a really good partnership of ours. When I started the PyData sort of global community sort of effort, we attached that essentially to NumFocus as well. So now NumFocus runs and is the center point of coordination for PyData meetups, PyData conferences all around the world. It's really grown and just really blown up. So that's been really, that's a constant and really great partnership with that foundation. Then That's, I would say, probably the primary one at this point. There's a lot of community events and things like that that we do as well, just to be good stewards, you know, and show up. But those drive a lot of awareness for us. One of the challenges from a business perspective is if you stay too close, just mingling with your friends, you're not going to sell much, because in our case, our friends are all users of the free stuff, right? And they're not necessarily the people who are signing the procurement checks to go and buy the enterprise software. So yeah, that's one of the dynamics there.
How do you stay current on what's a very hard domain?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I wouldn't go so far as to say I am current. I'm current on some things, and there's other things that I'm not as current on. We have just a very, very broad range of technical expertise under one roof here. So we have people working on compilers, people working on distributed computing, people working on visualization. We have people who are working on JavaScript front-end things for the enterprise software. We have people who are working on the back-end, so many things, containers and all the back-end coordination, orchestration kinds of things. Our consultants and trainers who go out in the field and talk to customers, they get exposure to a wide variety of different kinds of modeling problems, optimization problems, what's the state of the art in machine learning, deep learning, all these things. And I just have the great privilege of being able to talk to all these people and kind of glean from their learnings as much as I can. Now, I do some deep dives myself on some things. I have more time now than I've had in a while. That's part of it. But most recently, I've actually spent the last, I would say, 3 or 4 months really nerding out on, believe it or not, the physics and the anthropology and the human ecology around open source and open source ecosystems, communities, and how we do sustainable open source, how we continue innovation while maintaining stable software, the nature of software businesses as a whole, especially as it pertains to open source. So these are areas that I've actually been thinking about quite a lot. And I found that my physics metaphors or my physics intuition has helped me a lot in thinking about the system dynamics of that human ecology.
What are some of the challenges you think of starting an open source business, or I should say a business that uses open source as part of their model, mm-hmm. versus a straight commercial software company?
I have a snarky answer, which is that the challenges that face an open source company are theoretically no different than what face a commercial company. In practicality, they're different because a commercial company, one tends to have a fairly reasonable expectation that the investors of the company and their shareholders are the ones that the company is optimizing for. If the company does a great job, that's measured very quantifiably in returns to shareholders. That's the American model of capitalism. That's what a company does. So if you screw up the company, the only people you're going to piss off are your shareholders and your investors, probably your employees too. But in the open source side, if you're an open source software company, there's actually a much more explicit or intentional vision that matters. Most companies, they have a lot of like vision, mission, blah, blah, blah. For the most part, once you get to a certain size, the employees are all like, yeah, this is to make money, right? Unfortunately, you know, that's just the reality of it. Now, some businesses have highfalutin goals. Most don't actually even attempt to play to those. But in open source companies, the founders and the people who are stakeholders in it, there's a broader set of stakeholders. So who you piss off is a much bigger range than just the shareholders and employees. And so I would say that's the thing, is that failure means different things. And for open source companies, usually, it's sort of like you can split the whole world of living things into sort of prokaryotes and eukaryotes, right? Like in the world of companies, of open source companies, I would say you can cleave it into those that do open source as a means to an end and those for whom the open source embodies part of the ends itself. And how open source embodies and ends, now that itself can vary. For some people, there's a religious belief that all software should be free, and by golly, we're going to build this thing to be free. And those companies sometimes can struggle because there's this reluctance to charge for software because you believe software is free. And so they're limited to a particular kind of growth curve because the corporate financing is available to them is of a particular stripe because they're a consulting or services company. The ways that they can fuel innovation is also limited because they cannot go and sell a product as easily as someone else could. So those for whom just open source because it's open source, those companies who have that ends, you know, they're kind of constrained to one part of the landscape. Then there's other companies for whom open source is an ends and a means. And part of it is that it embodies some technical vision that the founders cared about. That technical vision is either only achievable through open source or gathered momentum and gathered user base and a way of doing things, a technical perspective that is now at this point so steeped, like the open source is part of its DNA, that it would seem like a violation and a rejection of everything that the soul of the company is to walk away from that. That's a different kind of ends, right? And then there's others, like I think from my perspective, we're a little bit of that, but then also from my perspective, there is a fairly opinionated view for us that open source is, it's a statement that we're not going to lock people out by closing the software. So it's almost like a statement of we may fight as a business and compete in a landscape that's rich and filled with many kinds of competitors, but one thing we're not going to do is we're not going to use closing down access to software as a means of either charging rent or fighting dirty, or a way to charge rent so we don't have to innovate anymore. So in that sense, being an open source company means that you are essentially committed. There's a covenant to your customers, to your users, to the ecosystem, to your employees. There's a covenant that you are going to innovate. Because it's so much harder to be just a rent-seeking monopolist as an open source company just around the software itself. So maybe that was a bit farther range than you were expecting from the answer. But
actually, you brought up one thing I wanted to ask you.
Uh-huh.
Does Anaconda actually have a lot of competitors?
There are some things that we do that are unique in the world. So on certain aspects of the technology and some of our product features, I would say we are very unique. Now, there are certain other things that we do, and particularly the software that we sell, that you know we think we're the best, but there may be other companies who think they are competitors, right? And so I think that from that perspective, and certainly it's up to the customers, not us, to say. So there are times when customers will, you know, bake us off against other things, and so we definitely have competitors in the enterprise space.
And you mentioned open source as requiring you to innovate, but has it also helped you to innovate?
Software is a collaborative, creative activity. And for some problems, for some kinds of projects, the kind of open collaboration that open source represents are the most effective way to harness collective intelligence and get something really useful out. In other cases, open source is actually the open source development methodology, if you will, way of engagement, it's actually not necessarily the most effective to harnessing innovation. And the dirty truth is, if you look at the way that open source projects actually roll, for all, you know, all the kumbaya aside, you look at how they actually roll, the most successful ones are launched by 1, 2, maybe 3-person founding team. I mean, 3 is pretty rare. Usually it's 1 or 2 people, usually 1, actually. And they, like a blaze of glory, they drop this code on the world. And other people start glomming on, and that initial nucleation site around the initial feature set, the collaborative dynamics of that, that really sets the future, like seals the fate of the project a lot of times. But usually open source projects, they launch when it is a blaze of glory sort of innovative leap from one person's brain. And even now, like if you look at, there's a really sad or interesting way of looking at this, like the maintainers of some of the most critical open source projects in Python that are used daily by millions and millions of people that back billions of dollars of commercial infrastructure activity, whether it's the power grid, whether it's keeping satellites up, whatever. I could fit all those maintainers in my minivan. Now, one could say, wow, witness the amazing leveraging power of open source. But you could also look at that and say, wow, that's really sad. We're under supporting and investing in these projects. So I'm a big believer in open source. I don't want this to sound like I'm like poo-pooing it. I'm a big believer in it, but I'm also a realist. And I think that open source in the early days had a lot more of the, you know, in the OSIFSF kind of days and all that. I mean, Stallman coming out and, you know, planting a stake in the ground and saying, we're doing open source. The commercial Unix people can go, you know, they can go pound sand, we're doing open source. That was important as a stake in the ground at the time. And over the 90s, as you know, the Linux folks tried to educate everyone about, hey, open source is okay, here's what it is, here's free software, and here's open source. Now, there's a very different dynamic as businesses are like, yeah, we don't care. Like the golden era of software is over. It's services, it's machine learning enabled services. These are where the top end of the value chain are. There's a real squishing compression dynamic on software that's happening, specifically just on open source software. And if we're not cognizant of that dynamic, if we don't step up as fans of open source software who love the collaboration dynamics of the community, if we don't step up and defend that and say, actually, if you're going to rely on this infrastructure, you need to be paying for the maintenance of it and not relying on volunteer labor. You know, I think that's a conversation that the free software world needs to have with the commercial world.
we found sometimes that being open source actually is a hindrance to us. Do you ever feel that? Like that open source makes your life more difficult?
So yeah, for venture capital fundraising, open source is a huge liability. Absolutely. Because VCs don't understand open source. The big ones, I would say. Like smaller funds that have maybe a little bit more, they can take a bit more of an opinion, be a bit more of a gambler on business models, things like that. Maybe certainly there's angels, you know, maybe there's angel funds that they believe in the technology or something like that. But the vast majority of VCs, they're there to really pattern match against business, known business models, known growth curves, you know, things like that. So if your business model is we're going to charge for the software, they're going to ask, well, how much value is the software? What do we believe the predictable growth curve looks like for this? If your business model is we're going to get users, then don't care if you give away the software, right? So it's all about when you talk to the VCs, how do you present them with an articulation of your long-term value, or not long-term value, but the returns you can generate on their investment? That's ultimately the only conversation they really care to have. So if they're investing in software and you're just giving it all away, it literally looks like you're just giving away their money. In fact, if you were to say, we're going to take the money, buy iPhones and give it away to everyone, they would at least understand that a little better because there's something tangible in an iPhone, right? They'd say, well, what are you going to get on the other side of it? You know, or I mean, give away, I think like movie pass or whatever, right? We're going to give away free movie tickets to people. We're going to lose money on every movie ticket. VCs are not afraid to lose money. They want to understand what that money is buying them, right? If it's buying something else, some other number, eyeballs, or users or something else, which you can then show how that converts into long-term revenue, they're happy for you to give away the money. But if it's simply we're funding software development and you're giving it all away and you can't show a conversion that they believe in to revenue, then it's not going to fly.
Were you ever concerned that perhaps the investment would come with strings that would make you to give up some of the mission or culture of open source?
As we were talking to investors, that was certainly one of the concerns. I mean, the reason we picked the investors we did was because we felt that they were mission aligned. And that's a real luxury. We're very lucky in that. We're pretty hard at the fundraising thing, especially as first-time founders, not knowing what we're doing. We talked to a lot of people, probably screwed up a lot of meetings, but we ended up with some folks that actually really understood not only the commercial potential of investing in this space in this company, but also the mission. So we've been pretty lucky with that. Again, I would say that it's rare to find that.
What advice would you give someone who wants to start an open source software business today?
Ultimately, the act of going into business, it's not a separable question from why are you going to business at all, right? Like if you're going to start a business, it's because you either A, want to fund some activity, B, you believe you have some unique thing that you can sell to the world or some unique service you can provide to the world. Though, you know, there's actually very few, a small set of valid reasons for starting a business, in my view. And attached to each of those reasons, if you do open source as a core activity, the question you have to ask yourself is, am I doing this as a means to an end? Or am I doing this, is this one of the main things I'm starting a business to do? If it's the latter, which I think is really where the meat of your question is, if someone says, I want to do open source software, but I also want to make money doing it somehow, there's many people who can, by building open source software, use it essentially as a marketing or brand awareness tool. And then they can freelance, they can build a very healthy consultancy from getting their name out there and being known. You know, that shouldn't be downplayed as a valuable thing. And you can build a reasonably good small business around that. But that's not going to get you into unicorn billion-dollar valuation territory. It just won't. Because to get to that level, you have to somehow get to a certain size of revenue. How do you take down a certain amount of revenue? Either you produce something like a piece of software that's extremely valuable that you sell a lot of, or you have a ton of people doing a lot of work. Scaling up a consultancy is highly non-trivial. Most software geeks who care a lot about technology are not wired to scale up a lot of meatware, if you will. Like once you get to a certain number of headcount, you have got to figure out as an entrepreneur and as a technical entrepreneur how to let go of parts of it and let someone else actually help you grow that. And that will change the culture and that will probably change part of the mission too. So if you want to scale to certain revenue sizes, you've got to do that either on the basis of providing really valuable scalable service or software. I would just say understand the dynamics. Don't blindly rush in with a whole bunch of optimism and then just curse your fate. Like there's a real dynamic here. Investors coming in to help put more gas in your gas tank, they will understand what road you're on, how far you're going to go. If you can't communicate to investors on the basis that they understand about what your business model and revenue models are, then you have no business asking them for their money. You know, don't get mad at them, right? So, I mean, it sucks in a sense that we live in this world where people do not think more about investing capital in socially aware activities or in generative sort of effective labor. That's a broader conversation outside the scope of this interview probably, but that's a systemic thing which I hope will resolve in 20, 30 years time. But at this point in time, it is just the reality of the investment, you know, field is what it looks like.
What were some of the businesses that you looked to as you were looking to scale Anaconda as businesses that you could model after?
We recognized that actually because we were not doing open core, that took a lot of our peer crowd of open source companies off the table, right? So like MongoDB is an example.
Could you just define open core real quick?
Sorry. It's where the core of the software is open source. And then to use, to put more data through it, or to run it on certain kinds of machines with more cores, or to do blah, 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 you know, additional features, additional whatever, charge money for it.
So like an enterprise version and a community version.
Yeah. A community version only supports 100 users. Enterprise is unlimited, right? Okay. Community version can only run in the cloud. Enterprise version can run on-prem. Like things like that. Open core. Yeah. It's the best way to define it, I guess.
I see.
The core of it is still open source. You know, it's still legit open source. Dual licensing, I think, also falls under that, right? So like you basically, the core is open source GPL and then commercial license. That's that dual license thing is also something that something that people do. So you can use it for free in a non-commercial setting. But as soon as you take it in-house in a commercial environment, your lawyers and their total like allergy to GPL will cause you to go and give IT a call to go buy the commercial license of the software. So you don't have to risk, you know, virally contaminating your internal software with GPL. Those are the kinds of models. And so we felt like many things in the data analytics space were in that kind of model. And certainly databases have this a bunch. We didn't see those as comparables. And when you look at platform software, there's Red Hat, really not that much else to compare to. We looked at some of the Java framework companies that managed to sell. Some got acquired by Red Hat, some got acquired by Oracle. For the most part, I mean, once we've figured out that we're just going to sell enterprise software, you know, by seats, by sometimes by nodes to customers, it actually became pretty straightforward how to think about the business. So in that case, it was really drive a lot of usage of the open source stuff, and that's going to drive a smaller but correlated usage and demand of the enterprise stuff, and that was it.
What did I miss, or is there anything else you want to add?
I would say that right now, I sort of just glanced by this comment earlier, but I really do think that right now the world of software is in transition. So people who want to start open source based software companies now should think long and hard about what does the value chain for software actually look like? It may be better just to do a software as a service kind of thing. And then you get to own the customer relationship. You own much more of the value chain, et cetera, et cetera. Now, there's downsides to that as well, but that's something to think about. Because I think that Andreessen talks about software eating the world, and that may be true, but I think less and less of what it eats has really high caloric value, right? More and more of the high calorie stuff is going to other kinds of things. So I would encourage people to think strongly about what it means to be a software business in the modern day, especially as things like Amazon, Google, Microsoft eat the world with cloud services. The second thing is understand what it is about open source that you love, that's intrinsic to your mission, and figure out and be very brutally honest with yourself about what of that you want to preserve and what are the right mechanisms for preserving that. Don't assume it's just a money problem. Don't assume it's just, oh, if I got out from this like horrible, soul-crushing corporate job, I could do open source all the time. There's always going to be a whole bunch of yak shaving from a business and management perspective, no matter what you do. Understand why you're taking that particular road, if you're going to take that road, right? And the third thing is open source doesn't exist in a vacuum. It exists in a human ecology of users, contributors, competitors, and an evolving technology landscape. You need to understand and think strongly about whether or not the thing you're building has long-term sustaining ecology value. And if it does, then it's worth investing. Otherwise, you might want to think about how to pull various other pieces of your ecosystem together into something that's more valuable as an agglomerate.
Peter Wang, founder of Anaconda, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom with us.
Thank you very much.
Best of luck.
Thank you.
Well, that's it for this first edition of Open Source Underdogs. Special thanks to the Linux Journal for co-sponsoring this podcast, to the All Things Open Conference, music from Broke for Free, Chris Zabriskie and Lee Rosevier, production assistance from Natalie Lau, operational support from William Lau, and from the staff at Anaconda. Next week, we'll talk to NetGate, a rare bootstrapped open source company who's also based in my hometown of Austin, Texas. Until then, thanks for listening.